way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women, desperately in need, will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And it's my pleasure to introduce Brandon M. from Wilmington, Delaware. Welcome, Brandon.
Hey, Gary. Thank you, Gary. And thank you to the group for having me here. And thank you, Billy, for inviting me. My name is Brandon, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, and, Brandon.
I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be sober. And just to do the particulars, my sobriety date is February 25th of 2011. I do have a home group, which is the Trolley Square Literature Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Thursday and Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. Still in a parking lot, but you know, I'll take a parking lot over not at all any day. And you know, I have a sponsor, and I'd have had the privilege of taking other alcoholics through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I try to remain active in all three sides of our triangle, unity, recovery, and service. Try to do my best to stay active in some aspect of general service, whether it be intergroup or district or area. I don't say that as some kind of like, look at me kind of checklist. I say it because, you know, I know for me, I found that those things have helped to keep me sober, have helped me to get in touch with this thing that, that we just read about. It helped me to, in my own way, establish a relationship with a power greater than myself through those actions and those continued actions. And it's funny, the other day, Billy had texted me, and we were texting back and forth, and he said a real funny line to me. And he said, thank you for your positive spirit. And, you know, that sounds like just kind of like a nice comment. But, you know, when I think about that through my alcoholic filter, you know, that is not something I would ever have equated myself to having, right? And it's not something I know historically that I was known for having. You know, I mean, I was always a glass half empty kind of person. And, you know, it's one of those things, and it was a simple thing that he had said, but sometimes hearing that from somebody else is kind of important, because, you know, and not because my ego needs it or anything like that, but as a reminder. Right? Because I could be in here, and I go to a lot of meetings each week. I spend a lot of time doing AA stuff with AA people, you know, and, you know, I'm definitely grateful. But sometimes I could also be, you know, it's almost like that word, like I'm grateful, kind of doesn't have the texture, you know, that, you know, and it loses its weight behind something that I fail to recognize the true value sometimes of what has really happened in here. And what has really happened, I know, to me, and you know, definitely to I'm pretty sure pretty much everybody in here, is a transformation. Something happened to take me from where I was 10 and a half years ago, which was in a very hopeless, negative pit of alcoholism, seeing no way out, to a place today where, you know what, no matter what happens, I know I'll be all right. And I know everything's going to be kind of cool, and everything's going to be good, right? That's a pretty big shift, right? And in the 12 and 12, one of the descriptions it uses is it says about, you know, how these people, and I'm probably going to misquote it, but it says, you know, about basically the complete rearrangements of thoughts, ideas, and motives and all that, right? And that is exactly what has happened to me here. Now, qualify myself, you know, so that you guys know I drank the way you drank and we did the same things, I will talk about my drinking, but I'm going to try not to spend too much time because a lot of good things have happened in sobriety that I'd like to talk about. But I do think it's important to make sure that, you know, that y'all know that I am an alcoholic. And, when I was young, I come from an Irish Catholic family, have three older sisters, and now I come from a family with a lot of alcoholic history. And, from a very young age, I was told I was genetically predispositioned to this thing. And for a long time in my life, I would have told you I drank a lot and I did a lot of things because of this or that, right? Because I grew up in an alcoholic household and there was trauma and this and all that stuff. But, I have three older sisters who to this day show no signs of alcoholism as I have come to know it. So I can't really pawn it off on upbringing. And just to kind of coincide with kind of the message and where we're going and how establishing this relationship thing is really kind of more important for me. Now I took my first drink, I had little baby drinks sitting on my grandfather's knee. He would give me a sip of his beer or whatever. And I think lots of kids do that, But the one time I remember when I actually felt the effect of alcohol, and this, I was real young. I was about 6-7 years old, and my mom would put wine around the Christmas table. When we were having Christmas dinner, she would put a glass of wine around the table for each of us. And I remember I went around and I drank everybody's wine, and I started running around like a chicken without a head, and I remember, I got all hot and stuff like that. But it wasn't like I jumped on the table or started, pulling fist fights. I was a little kid, I was really a baby by most standards. But I do know like there was something to happen and, I felt attention and people laughed and all that. And I liked attention. I mean, I was always kind of vying for attention in my house. I didn't go into kindergarten the next day and start, wearing a hip flask or anything like that, or start beating up kids in the bathroom or anything. I went along like a kid does. But I think just in the same way where, I went to my first AA meeting and a seed was planted on that day that would later come to sprout at the opportune time, right? There was something that was planted in my head that day when I was, on that Christmas day when I was a little kid, that some kind of something was there in that magical elixir, and it would come back later on, like Bill says, to cut me in like a boomerang. through my childhood, there was it wasn't like I said, I didn't start drinking and doing things until on a regular basis until I was probably around 11, 12 years old. But the thing that really kind of, for me, that's kind of sticking out in my head today is, we talk about establishing a relationship with God. And, I was, like I said, I was raised Catholic, and, I did all the little good Catholic boy things, communion, confirmation, penance, all that stuff. And I went to Sunday school or CCD, catechism, whatever you want to call it, every week, because my mom told me I had to go to Sunday school or catechism every single week. And we went to church on Sundays more often on holidays, but you know, but we went, right? And I'd go because my mom told me I had to go, right? But in my mind, up until around my early, you know, preteen years, in my mind, that constituted doing the God thing, you know, and having an understanding of God. Now, at the same time in my life, like I said, you know, it was an alcoholic household, and lots of things were happening. I mean, my father was a very violent, abusive alcoholic, and he was a Vietnam vet, super depressive. And I mean, there were a couple times, you know, throughout my childhood where we walked in on him and he had just drank a bottle of scotch and downed a bottle of pills trying to kill himself. And we saw those things a couple times throughout my childhood, and we saw the violence and the cops coming every night, and them taking my dad away, and them and my dad beating up my older sister and my mom. Now, like I said, none of that makes me an alcoholic, but I'll tell you the one thing it for sure did was it took away any kind of positive outlook I had on life. It took away any ability that I had to trust that there was some kind of God or superhuman being out there that loved me and wanted the best for me and that could be trusted, you know? And I remember when I was 11 years old, my father followed through and he ended up taking his life, and it was Christmas morning. And I remember come down and we're opening our presents and we get the call from the VA hospital where he was. And they had said, you know, he had committed suicide. And I'll tell you, after that, you couldn't have told me a thing. You couldn't have told me anything that there was a God up there. He hadn't come in my house. I know that much. That's what my thinking was. There was no God in my house. I did the good Catholic boy things. I went to church. I went to CCD. I did what my mom told me to. You know, and that absolute disconnect happened, I could say for sure, right around then, a certain disconnect. Because going forward from there, I would, you know, for years, I mean, one, you know, I would do anything to try to argue or belittle or down talk about any type of religion or God or anything like that. It was a piece of business of mine whenever somebody brought up something like that. And coinciding around that same time, I also, I started to, you know, do what people who have a lot of problems do, is start to hang out with people who have a lot of problems just like me, right? And started surrounding myself with the troubled kids, and, you know, got into trouble and we got into things. And, you know, and it was pretty much like one of those, like most kids, or what I perceived most kids were doing in seventh, eighth grade. You know, I figured everybody was sneaking into their older brother's cabinets and trying to sneak out a bottle of liquor from their parents' liquor cabinet and rummaging through people's drawers, trying to find whatever we could find. I didn't go and end up getting, you know, whacked out of my mind every single day. But I'll tell you what, it became a certain thing that it was something that I was always willing and looking to do, you know. One thing about my drinking from a very, very young age, I mean, before I could even, you know, like I remember after years of being, a couple of years of being sober, actually looking back and trying to review my drinking. And I can't ever think of a time where, you know, it was just one or two and I stopped. There was never a time that I had that desire in me to stop. It was always drink until it's gone or until I black out. But I thought if you would have asked me then, I would have told you the only problem with what I was doing was that I was too young and I wasn't supposed to be doing those things. Obviously it's illegal. I shouldn't be drinking underage, but you know, I just thought I was doing what kids do. And throughout high school, I mean, I just kind of, you know, when I gravitated towards, you know, those who were, you know, like the burnouts and the partiers and all that. And I was able, always pretty much able to skim by, right? You know, as long as I could pull off a D and a C, you know, I'm good, right? You know, I might've had to do summer school a couple times, but hey, you know, I figured, consequences of my actions. know, and I always, straight through school, from the time I was 12 years old, I always had a job. I started off working, you know, as like a little broom pusher and a key maker at the Ace Hardware when I was like 12. And then I started working at a bakery washing dishes when I was 14. And I worked straight through, and I always hung my hat on that too later on. The fact that I was always employable and I always had a job and I could always take care of my stuff. You know, I could, you know, and one of the things that was actually very accommodating to me, you know, like my mom, I held a lot of resentment against her for not being there later on. And, you know, but she, God bless that woman. I mean, around the same time when my father died, my grandfather, which was her father, and her mother and her grandmother all died within a period of like a year and a half, 2 years. And that woman did all she could to take care of the four of us kids on $9 an hour in New Jersey. And even back then in the 80s, in the early 90s, that's not a lot of money. I mean, to take care of. I mean, the rent was still, or the mortgages and the property tax were still high then. But, you know, I remember I'd help hold that against her for years. About how she wasn't there for me. And so, of course, in my mind, I'll get a job. I'll take care of it. I don't need you. You know, I'm self-reliant, and which was good because I didn't want her knowing what I was spending my money on anyway. And, you know, and there was funny little things that happened, though. Like Bill talks about in his story, he talks about ominous warning that I failed to heed. And, there was a lot of ominous warnings that I failed to heed along the way, kind of telltale signs. I remember the one time I was like 14 years old and I came home from a party and me and my buddies were drinking in the woods, and I came home, pedaled my little bicycle home and came into the house. My mom realized I was drunk, started a big screaming match between us. And I remember I went to make a beeline because I'm out of here, right? I'm going to get on my little bicycle and pedal away. And I remember like my mind was like, I'm going to go meet up with my buddy, you know, because I always had some of those hoodlum friends who, you know, you could go to their house any time of day. And, you know, it was always party time. And I remember that was in my thought. And I went out to the garage and I got on my little bicycle and I opened the door. And my mom was standing at the end of the door saying, "You're not going nowhere." And I remember I pulled out a big fishing knife and I started chasing after her with it. And you know, I look back and I look at friends, you know, who have kids and kids around that age. And I think about them doing those kind of things. I mean, there was a lot of ominous warnings that I failed to heed, because even all throughout high school, I mean, I did a stint in rehab when I was in high school, which I would have told you it was just bad luck that the police were there at the wrong time and I had to go to jail, or I did my time in jail and then I had to go to rehab because it was the only way I was going to be able to have my license, because it was either a month in rehab or lose my license till I was 21. And it seemed like a very simple decision to make. I mean, take a month vacation, go to rehab, cry about some stuff, tell them I'm sad and all this, you know, but on the act, I'll get out and I could go to be the kid, right? It was just bad luck that I got caught. And you know, and funny thing, you know, like I graduated high school, you know, by the skin of my teeth, but I graduated. And you know, and I started having those things, which, you know, like, I had a bad relationship that failed and I was starting to have problems with friends and stuff like that. And you know, in my mind, it was always kind of like, you know what? I really need to get out of New Jersey. You know, it's this town, it's these people. I don't, you know, I'm way too smart, way too slick and all this stuff. And I mean, by that time, straight through high school, I was going up into the city, into Manhattan, and like going to the all night dance clubs and stuff like that. And I was like, I'm just going to go live up in the city and, you know, live around people who are more open and, you know, they're not going to care about what I'm doing. They're be too busy minding their own business. And so, of course, you know, first of my geographic changes, you know, I moved up to New York and met a girl. We got married, you know, and you know, lived up there, did really good, had a job, you know, had one of those I had arrived moments, right, where I was, you know, working as a junior executive and making lots of money and drinking Sambuca with the boss on a Friday afternoon, and everything was pretty good until, you know, after a while the proposals had to start coming in because I was doing sales, and, you know, the pressure started to come on, and I started to think maybe it's time to get out of New York because there's a lot going on here, right? Taxes are high. It was 9/11 had happened, and I thought, well, the city's a bad place to be anyway. I don't want to live in the city after 9/11 anymore. And so me and my ex-wife, we moved down to Florida. And as like any place, you know, I go someplace new, it's shiny, it's new, things get a little better for a little bit. And then after a little while, I show up. And, you know, and the funny thing, and all due respect, like throughout high school, a lot of my stuff, you know, now a lot of the time when I drank, I would drink to the point of throwing up, especially younger. So I did a lot of things through high school that didn't cause me to throw up as much. But then when I moved down to Florida, and I was like, you know what, now I'm just going to be a grown up. I'm going to stop playing around with all the drugs and the hard stuff. I'm just going to drink like a grown up. And I'll tell you, you know, I thought I loved alcohol before that. But, you know, when I took all those other things that's kind of helped suppress my alcoholism out of the equation, and it was just alcohol, I mean, there was a love affair that was started that would go on for the next, you know, 10 years. I very quickly became a daily drinker. You know, I was definitely, without a doubt, a hard partying drinker before that. But there, after that, there was no doubt I was an everyday alcoholic. And it was just alcohol. And, of course, not too long after that, my ex-wife, decided to leave, which I figured was probably better. She was kind of, I didn't really like her anyway. You know, it was a bad decision getting married. It was really just out of convenience. I mean, she was good at paying bills. I was good at spending money. So, you know, she would pay the bills with her money. I'd spend my money to party. And really I didn't have the, you know, because of that fear inside of me, I didn't have the guts when I came to realize that I didn't really love her. I didn't have the guts, and I was too much of a coward to call it off. Right. So I, you know, at one point I just figured I'm just going to ride this through, right. Just going to ride this marriage through. Hopefully, you know, death will come pretty soon, I'm sure. Right. And, but of course she ended up leaving me, you know, and I, for years, even into my sobriety, up until I did a 4-step, I would tell people that we had an amicable split, which it was nothing close to amicable. She left me 2 or 3 days before Christmas because the paychecks couldn't come home, because I was doing things with other women that a married man should not be doing. You know, that I was lying to her, manipulating her, you know, cheating, all that stuff. And she left, which I was, you know, all right, good, you go, you know. And I already had somebody else in the wings that I was looking at anyway, right? You know, I already had my next victim lined up, who was a girl I worked with. And it's funny because, you know, the next woman I was with after that, because, you know, of course, anything, you know, I found the next girl, and everything was shiny and new, and she was the one. She was literally, like, if there was, you know, a woman in my life that I loved, she definitely was the woman I loved. I still joke around and call her the one to this day. She was the one that, you know, I fell for, and I fell for her hard. And I loved the hell out of that girl, pardon my French. And we had it good for a little while, and everything kind of came together for a little while. You know, it was another I had arrived moment. I had a really good job. I was driving this beautiful Acura that I wanted so bad. And we had this nice townhouse, and it was right on a lake, and there was alligators in the backyard and the little lake behind our house. It was picturesque. It was perfect. She was beautiful and sweet, a very, you know, like one of those good corn fed kind of wholesome girls from down in Florida. And I loved her. I loved her to bits. But Bill, in his story, he says there was many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. And there was many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous townhouse, I'll tell you that. you know, everything looked really good on the outside. And if you would ask me how everything was going, I would have told you about how I got a nice car and how I got a nice job and how I got a nice girl and how I'm making lots of money. But if you came behind the doors of into our townhouse in the middle of the night, you would have seen her screaming at me or us screaming at each other or her saying to me, why? Why'd you do it again, Brendan? I remember one time, and there's a line in our book, and it really kind of hit me in the gut when I saw it. And it talks about some of those things that we hear people say about the alcoholic. And he says, she's a sweet girl. You would think he would stop for her sake. And I remember her saying that exact phrase to me, almost verbatim. Said, I'm a sweet girl, Brendan. I take care of you. I give you everything you want. Why can't you just do this for me? And the thing is, I wanted to do it for her, and I loved her to death. But I'll tell you what, you know, like, and to quote the name of that book, you know, when love is not enough, you know, and it's just not enough. You know, as much as I loved her, I had this thing that is so much bigger that was driving me. And I started to realize that maybe there's something going on. And she threatened to leave. And I said, you know what, you probably should leave because I'm probably going to hurt you. And not like I was going to beat her up, but I was, you know, I knew I was going to hurt that girl emotionally. And she left, and I decided I should move back up to New Jersey, like, you know, make another geographic change. And, you know, in my mind, I had to go up and make my peace with all my stuff growing up. You know, maybe if I make my peace with the dad stuff, maybe if I make my peace with my family, this thing will all go away. And I moved back up to New Jersey. I moved in with my sister. My sister, you know, I manipulated her really well. I told her, listen, I just need to come back up there, get my feet on, you know, and get myself settled, and it'll be good. And she was like, she had just gone through a divorce, and she was raising her two kids on her own. And she's like, yeah, you could come up. You know, you pay me $500 a month for rent because I'm paying this mortgage on my own, and I'm trying to take care of the kids. You could help me out, and I'll help you out. I'll give you a place. It's fantastic. Right. And I moved back up, and I was good for a little bit, like anything, you know, the shine's there, everything's new. And of course, a little while later, you know, I show up, and there's a book I remember. So which kind of coincides right with where I'm going, right? There was a woman, I went to go see a therapist, and it was in my mind that maybe she'd do some kind of hypnotizing thing or say some stuff to me, and it would bring up some like childhood thing that I'd been repressing, and I'd cry, and then poof, all my alcoholism would go away. Right. And I remember she said a bunch of different things, man. She had recommended this book called Wherever You Go, There You Are, which I later came to find out was about an alcoholic. But it's the truth. Wherever I go, there I am. And I remember the one thing about that therapist, after probably about our third visit, she had made the suggestion, which, you know, the suggestion that no alcoholic ever wants to hear. And she said, how about you stop drinking for a little while and then we could work on your problems? And I said, oh, no. How about we work on my problems and I won't want to drink? And she said, it don't work like that. And so, of course, I think I went to maybe one or two more sessions with her and then stopped seeing her. But she did one thing, though. She gave me a meeting list for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't go at first. Actually, I didn't go for probably a good month or so afterwards. I remember when I first went, it was because, you know, it was like one of those things. It was a Tuesday. I went out to the city all week and I spent all my money. My account was overdrafted. I was late for work. I felt like hell. I was waking up and wanting to kill myself. So I was like, or whatever, I'll go to this meeting, right? And I went into the meeting and immediately disqualified myself right out, right? I went in looking at everybody's outsides, you know, looking at everybody around me and trying to decide why I was different from them, you know, and I walked myself away. And, you know, after, in the years after that, you know, it, like things started to happen. You know, I started, of course, racking up the DUIs. And of course, you know, when you get a DUI, at least up here, when you get a DUI, I had gotten a DUI in Manhattan, and they had, you know, part of it was you had to go to the 8 DUI classes for, you know, a class a week for 8 weeks. And then you also had to go to a meeting a week for 8 weeks and get the little slip signed and stuff like that. And I went, right? Because, you know, I'm not going to say I didn't go, right? I don't want to look bad, right? You know what I mean? They're not going to hold that against me. And I remember I went, and I'd go, and, you know, I remember at that time the city of New York had taken my car away because they did this thing called forfeiture, where they not only took your license, they took your car as well in a whole separate course case. And I remember I had to ride my bike up to the meetings, and I'd ride up and I'd go to the meeting, and then I'd, you know, pedal home and stop at the liquor store on the way home and drink, and then do it again. And do it again, and do it again. And I remember everybody was always really nice to me, but I still didn't feel like I belonged. You know, I still had that thing inside of me that said, no, there's something, it's something else. You know, maybe if I get her back, it'll go away. Maybe if I get a better job, it'll go away. Maybe if I get a good education, it'll go away. There's got to be something else, you know? And the thing is, like, inside there is one part of me that I couldn't have verbalized this at that time. You know, everything, this hindsight, you know, looking back, you know, but, you know, the reality is, I know that there was a part of me that was deathly afraid of not drinking. And that kept me going. You know, I'd love to say that, you know, it was like, you know, I went into those couple of meetings and I got sober and poof, everything was fantastic. And I skipped along my happy-go-lucky way, right? But I'll tell you, man, those first 4 or 5 years in AA, going there on a regular basis, 2 to 5 meetings a week, were the worst years of my life. You know, and I'd go to the meeting, go home, drink, wake up, want to kill myself. You know, there's a line in the doctor's opinion, and I remember when I first read it, it was the one that kind of hit me most out of the doctor's opinion. And it says, once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up upon them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That was every morning. You know, that and waking up to the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. You know, and you know, like going kind of back to that thing about, you know, what I said in the beginning about Billy saying, you know, like about being a positive spirit. There was nothing positive that I could see at that time. You know, that whole time, you know, I remember people would say things to try to, you know, boost me up and try to say, it'll be all right, Brendan. You just got to, you know, pull yourself together, you know, and everything. And, you know, I was a yeah, but guy. You know, even if they said something good, yeah, but, you know, oh, Brendan, it'll be okay. Yeah, but, you know, the shoe was always getting ready to fall. Right. And a lot of times, you know, because they only knew what I let them know, right? You know, I had never told everybody everything that was going on, because there was always so much going on, so much piled up in my head that was way too much, and I could never see myself getting out of it. You know, racking up the credit card debts, because, I mean, I don't know who these credit card companies are, but at least back then, they had some real foolish people doing their business, man. I would rack up a credit card and then stop paying it. And then somebody else would send me one. I'd be like, well, hey, you know, why not? I'll pay it back someday, you know, and knowing I would never pay it back. And, you know, and the more I did that, and the more I mean, I had myself in this constant rotating cycle of overdrafting my account every week and not having any money, like, and all that. And I remember doing things that I really felt ashamed of too around that time. And I remember I'd get paid on Friday night, and I'd go out, and I'm just going to go out with some friends. I'm just going to have a couple of drinks, you know, and I could go to the meetings on Monday. I'll start on Monday. You know, always a firm resolution, never a decision. And I'll stop on Monday. And I remember I'd go out on Friday night, and I'd live the high life on Friday night and drink Heineken and top shelf stuff. And by Sunday morning, I'm drinking bottom of the barrel, rock gut kind of stuff. And by Monday morning, I'm broke, and that thing's on me, and I ain't got no money. And I remember my sister had her kids living in the house, and they were at school, and I'd go up into their little bedroom drawers in their nightstands and rummage through looking for change and stuff to steal from them. Cause, you know, and I'm gonna put it back, you know, but I need something right now. And, you know, that type of stuff just kind of compounds everything. And around those years, you know, there was the point where I started to really try to stop drinking. And I tried with every bit of me. And there's those two parts, that line in We Agnostics, where it says, you know, once having, sorry, I'm going to misquote for a second. Let me not do that, all right? Let me do the book justice. It talks about how, which usually I'm pretty good at quoting this one right off my tongue. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic, right? And I never had control over the amount I took, but the thing that really killed me was when I honestly wanted to stop, I found I could not quit entirely. And that's a painful, painful thing. You know, and as I started to see that this thing was never going to go away, and that depression started to build up. And I mean, every day I'd wake up and want to kill myself. And, you know, I couldn't see a way out. And I remember, you know, on my final drunk, I went out and I was going to go to an AA meeting, and, you know, somewhere along the way, you know, it happened. The switch went off, and I was, you know, went from going to an AA meeting to go to get drunk, and series of events happened. I got into an accident, did a hit and run accident, and while drunk driving, and ended up getting caught like four blocks away because I'm not really good at running when I'm drunk, and the police are pretty good at finding me when I'm drunk. And I remember I came out of jail the next morning after that, and I just decided, you know, that's it. I'm just going to ride this thing out and end it. And I had a good number of days of drinking with what little money I could come up with. And I remember the one night finally got to the point where I was standing on top of a toilet with a belt around my neck. And I remember saying, I was like, God, you know, you haven't done anything for me in my life. You've never done me any favors. There's one thing you could do for me. Just help me end this. Take this thing away because I can't do it no more. And I was beaten, and I begged him. And I mean, I'm standing on there, and I know I had that belt on good enough, and I know I had it high enough, and I know all I had to do was drop to my knees and it would all go away. And I couldn't get together the power to even do that. And, you know, and I always say, you know, the one thing I know for sure is God did take my life that night, and he took my life and he gave me a new one, you know, because the next thing I know, I was down on the beach. I ended up in Atlantic City, which, you know, just was just by chance. Seemed like a good idea, you know. And I ended up down on the beach, and I'm on my knees, and I'm crying, and I'm not sure what to do. And I remember I walked into a police station, which was one I just walked out of, you know, for a DUI not too long before. And I walked in and I said, listen, I need help. And apparently there was a missing persons out on me. And apparently they also thought I was probably suicidal. So they booked me in a little room and told me to hold on. And then the people came with the bed with the straps on it and strapped me down and took me down to the psych ward. And you know what? It's a funny thing, because I remember as they were putting the little bracelet on my arm, you know, they take a little picture of you and they put it on a little bracelet, you know, maybe so you could look at yourself and, hey, look, it's me. You know what I mean? But you know what I mean? But I remember they put it on there, and I remember there was this grin inside on my face. And there was something inside that told me, like, you know what? It's done. It's over. And, you know, and after spending my time there, the only place they had available to me was a Salvation Army in Wilmington, Delaware. And I didn't know anything about Wilmington, Delaware, and never been there before. But, you know, the other option was homeless, and it was February, and all I had was a pair of jeans and a, you know, and a hoodie. So, you know, homeless, Salvation Army seemed like an easy choice to make, right? So I remember I went there, and that first night there's a whole bunch of guys, and we're sitting around in this little TV room they had, and they're joking and they're talking, and they're all telling stories, and I'm not saying nothing because I'm not going to incriminate myself, and I'm not getting them any kind of information about me, right? They might use it against me later. And you know, and they're all joking and they're talking about these things that I would find mortifying or embarrassing, and they're laughing, and there was a freedom about them. And I remember, like, after sitting there for a little while, and everybody kind of went back to their bedrooms, and it was me and this one other guy, and we were sitting and talking, and he said, so what happened? And I just let it all out. And for the first time in my life, I was honest with somebody about everything that had been going on inside, and about how much it hurt, and how much I wanted to stop and I couldn't, and how badly I wanted to kill myself and I couldn't do that right, and how I destroyed every relationship, and how I was never going to make it right, and how I was so far in debt and it was impossible for me to get out of. And everything I had said I did that I felt disgusting about or felt embarrassed about, he said, yeah, I've done that. I felt that way. I drank like that. I did those things. And I had that thing that's most important in here, you know, that moment of identification, one alcoholic to another. And I don't know why I trusted that man other than the other men. But the one thing I do know is he had his head in the big book. He, you know, funny enough, you know, he ended up becoming my first sponsor. And, you know, we were actually, I know Billy was there like a month ago, and at a meeting we do with our sponsorship family on Saturday. And this guy was talking about how somebody had ignited something within them that they couldn't keep lit in themselves. And that was the same thing. My first sponsor, to this day, he can't stay sober. He doesn't get more than maybe like 6 months to 2 years, and he goes back out. But I could tell you that one thing, that man ignited something in me. You know, he was exactly, I believe God used him as his agent at that day. So I try to never disqualify who that message is coming for, because I don't know who it is coming for and why it's coming from that person. You know, I don't think God has, you know, a set of standards by who he will use. I think we're just there to avail ourselves to be used. And, you know, and like, you know, the thing about that, you know, I went through my step 1, 2, and 3 with him. And then I did my 4 with another sponsor, because he ended up getting relapsing. And, you know, there was a funny part about what happened around then. And, you know, I was in program for a year, because I guess some of us are a little sicker than others. But, you know, I came out of there, and I remember I was living with two friends who I'd met in rehab, and they were my roll dogs, you know, they were my buddies. We went to meetings together and everything. We hung out all the time. And we got into this apartment together, the three of us, and it was one of the worst neighborhoods in Wilmington. And I remember I was there for like 3 weeks and my sponsor had just relapsed. And all of a sudden my one buddy starts doing heroin and the other friend starts smoking crack. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, I just want to stay sober. You know, I don't know what to do. And the only thing I had to do was just go to AA meetings because it was the only place where I could get out of that noise and the craziness that was going on there. And I threw myself into meetings and I was going to a meeting, an early risers meeting every morning and a meeting every night, whether at the 7 o'clock or the 8 o'clock meeting. And there was this little meeting of probably about five or six guys that met up every Thursday and Sunday at my home group. And they needed somebody to make coffee. And it was really because everybody there was horrible at making coffee. And I was really good at it, my opinion. But I didn't want to drink their horrible coffee. I would make it much better. And one of the greatest, I think that still to this day is one of the greatest things that has happened to me, was showing up every week to make coffee for that meeting. Because there's this funny deal, and I remember my sponsor Bob talking about it the one time about, you know, how making somebody else feel welcome makes us feel welcome, right? And every week I'd show up there, and, you know, I'd be there early because, you know, you got to be there early to get off the coffee and get everything set up and make sure everything's set up on time, because nobody likes when the meeting's only 5 minutes before the start and the coffee hasn't been done percolating yet, right? Everybody gets crazy about that. So I wanted to be thorough, right? But you know, the funny thing is, like, I didn't, other than that, like, my two friends had relapsed, my sponsor had relapsed, and I didn't know anybody else in Wilmington, Delaware. And I just showed up there and I made coffee and I made coffee and I made coffee and I made coffee. And there's a line in our book, and it talks about, to see a fellowship grow up around you, it's an experience you must not miss. And you know, in doing so over the years, I've seen a fellowship grow up around me. I've met people who I love with my heart, every bit of my heart, and they mean the world to me. And you know, and sometimes I really don't like Delaware. It's funny because every once in a while I find myself in having those periods and I'm like, I'm getting out of here. It's time for me to go. But then I keep showing up at that stupid little meeting and, you know, just trying to make the newcomer feel welcome. And I know exactly why I'm here. And I know exactly the purpose I'm here. And in that, I have seen a fellowship grow around me. You know, that meeting that was at one time only about six guys had its period where it sometimes, I mean, the room could only had a fire department capacity of 40 people. And I mean, there was times, and it's heyday, where we had like 80 people jammed into that room, which I'm sure the fire marshal would not have liked if he came and saw, but you know, we were like, we're helping people, you know? You know, and I've seen people come and go, and I've had the privilege of sponsoring tons of people because of that group. You know, I mean, we were what was considered a dark or an inactive meeting, you know, and as, you know, my interest in like service and the traditions and stuff like that started to grow, you know, that group now, you know, it, you know, at first we had an intergroup rep, and then we had started getting intergroup commitments to bring the message into the hospitals and detoxes. And then we started giving money to intergroup, and then we started getting connected with a GSR and general service and area and all that. You know, and that's been one of the greatest opportunities. I mean, in my periods of being a GSR, going to like, you know, like the NARASA, which for us is the Northeastern Regional Service Assembly. And I love that stuff and the people that it's put me in contact with, to see the broad, the whole of AA, and to see that we are so many and we are so very alike. and there is so much magic and love happening here. And bring it all the way back around to that positive thing. And like I said, in the last couple years of my drinking, and even from the time I was a kid, I didn't have a positive outlook. You know, and going through the steps, you know, I established a relationship with a God of my understanding, which is great, right? And I could sit there and pray and meditate and have that relationship to that extent. But there's that line, and it says, you know, for if he failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, you know, he couldn't meet the certain trials and low spots ahead. And I found over the years that everything in my life has come from AA and the God that AA has introduced me to. Besides the obvious things, you know, which I get to be a good uncle today, and I get, you know, that nephew and that niece, you know, I was able to, you know, give him the money back that I stole from him, which was nice. But I remember, you know, my nephew, I didn't like him for a long time. I thought he was spoiled and he had it way better than I did. And I was jealous. And, but, you know, because of these steps in this program, you know, I was able to make amends and try to take the actions of a good uncle, because you guys showed me how to take the actions of being a good uncle. And about 4 years ago, that boy was getting married and he asked me to be the minister for his wedding. And when I asked him, I said, "Bud, you know, like, I'm not a minister. You know, you sure you don't want something else?" And he goes, "Uncle Brendan, I don't think anybody I know has any, like, more of a spiritual connection." And he just, those types of things. And, you know, my little niece. And so my niece got about 5 minutes left, and I'll try to squeeze everything in I can, but, you know, I'll never be able to do it all. There's so much has happened, but no, and it's been probably one of the hardest things. So my sister, the oldest one, she always, even when I was a kid, was kind of like a backup mom to me. And I took that woman through the ringer with every bit of my alcoholism. She was the only one who, over the last couple of years, was the one who was willing to let me into her house. And I screwed her over time and time again. I mean, under the guise I was supposed to pay her $500 a month in rent. And over the 3 or 4 years I lived there, I think I might have paid her 9 times at best. But she still let me stay. And she, you know, I remember a time where I got drunk out on her deck and almost burned the whole deck down because it was a good night to have a fire. You know what I mean? And I did lots of dumb stuff. I backed up into her now husband's patrol car when I was drunk one night. I demolished one of her cars. And I put in front of those kids who I was supposed to help the vision of what an alcoholic looks like. And they saw things. They saw their uncle falling all over the place and just being an absolute mess. And, you know, my sister near the end said, "I don't want you anywhere near my house. You can't come near it. You'll never come in my house again." And not too long after I got sober, we found out my niece was addicted to heroin. And she went in and out for a number of years. And I tried a lot to help her. You know, and I tried to be a voice of, like, a positive message. And I tried to be there for my sister, as a good brother would be, to try to just give her hope And last year, my niece finally overdosed and she died. And you know, there's a couple things. You know, one, I know at the end of the day, I tried everything I could do to try to be there for my sister and my niece, because you guys told me how to try to be there and to be helpful without shoving my hands into everything, to just show up, to be a brother, to show up and be an uncle. You know, I don't have to force AA down her throat, right? I could just show up and be a good brother and a good uncle. And I know I did my best with that. And, so when that happened, I literally, when I found out, I had just gotten off the plane and got into the hotel at this retreat that we do with our sponsor out in Vegas. And I got into my hotel and my sister called me and she said, "Brendan, are you settled? Are you all right?" And I said, yeah, what's going on? And I knew it, you know, and she told me. And I said, "Well, listen, you know, I'll try to get home and I'll try to get back fast." And the thing she said, no, I'm glad you're there. You're exactly where I need you to be. And I'm glad that you're there with them, because I know that's the best place you can be. Because my family knows and loves and respects and is grateful for you guys today. And, you know, I've been able to be there for my sister, you know, since then. And, you know, I can't say enough about this program, and I know it's going to be all right. You know, I know she's going to be all right. You know, I know everything's going to be all right. You know, because I was once the person who was, if this happens, that's it. It's all going to go to hell. But, you know, the one thing I know for sure if I stay with you guys and I try to show up and I just try to do my best to be a good AA, everything's going to be all right. Because everything has been all right since I've been doing it. And there's no reason for me to doubt it. So I can be positive today. And it's all a direct result of you guys and the God you guys have shown me. So I want to thank you for my time here and thank you for the opportunity to be a useful to AA, and thank you for your service. And that's all I got.
Ooh, wow, Brendan, thank you so much. That's awesome. What a story. Trying to get it together here myself. That was powerful, Brendan. And you are an example of recovery in AA, and that's awesome. And thank you so much for sharing all that with us tonight. So touching. I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. We're going to go ahead and wrap this meeting up so we could all unmute and thank Brendan properly. We have, I will